Hello, this is Informer, a show that reveals the latest ideas from artists, thinkers, and technologists. Informer invites you behind the screen to meet the people sketching, hacking, and imagining the next versions of our world. I'm Roddy Schrock, your host, and in each episode, I spotlight creative minds grappling with a changing world through art, technology, or often both. And I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast at informerpodcast.com, where you can also find show notes, links, and more information on all of the artists and projects that we discuss. It's always a pleasure to speak with Mindy and Keith Obadike. The sound art duo have been working together for 25 years, which gives them perspective to be able to identify trends, changes, and ongoing challenges in the field. Their sound work is beautifully designed, often utilizing the human voice as an instrument, and frequently tackling issues ignored in sound art, like race relations in the United States, or the country's histories of exclusion. In this conversation, we covered a lot of ground, including their recent refusal to accept an award from ZKM, a major media arts center in Germany, when the Institute described an alleged difficulty in balancing quality versus diversity in their awards. As usual, though, I began our talk by asking them of their early memories of sound as an artistic medium. But one thing that I've been asking everyone that I've been speaking to on this podcast is to just recount some of your earliest memories of working or thinking about sound as an art form or technology as an area that intrigued you.
I know the answer to this, but I don't know if it really, well, I'll just tell the story. I took an acting class as a child, and it was acting for camera. And one of the things that they did during that time was we created sound effects. And what we did to create sound effects, like to make the sense of a crowd, was there were just certain phrases that a couple of people had to say, and then there were different ways you could be, like in a restaurant, and doing that stuff off camera was so intriguing to me that that's all I did when I got home. You know, I just had a tape recorder and all these like tools, and I was only one person, so I was trying to make the sound of a crowd. But I remember just learning that you could create sounds that would give you an effect that were very different from what you were doing. And so to me, that was just a place of play for most of my childhood after that point. How that connected to, they didn't immediately connect to my wanting to be an artist as an adult until much later. That didn't come into much later, but it was something that really affected my sense of sound as an area of play.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
You know, I'm trying to think about it. I mean, there are a lot of stories. I mean, I grew up playing music. We're both from Nashville, Tennessee. So it's a music city. There's studios everywhere. But before I thought of myself consciously as a musician, now I have to say there were no musicians in my family. But I remember, like, as a kid, I always asked for like musical instruments for gifts. And then I would take those things apart. And but, you know, Mindy and I, we also discovered that, you know, when we were kids, she moved to Nashville a couple of years later. So she wasn't born in Nashville, but mm-hmm. she came as a small kid. We didn't meet, but we attended the same concert. Like, there's a great pianist, UB Blake. And UB Blake came to Nashville. I think he performed at Fisk University. Mm-hmm. And we were both at that concert. And so it was a kind of unusual intersection.
And it was one of his last concerts, and he was about to be 100 or something. Yeah. Wow. You know, it was a very, you know, very old ragtime musician. Our parents both took us, and it had a formative effect on me too, because yeah. I didn't know what I was seeing, but when he died, I remember reading the articles and I was like, I was there. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. But so for me, I think a lot of it, and maybe this is true for you too, a lot of it was about the city. I mean, the city really yeah. sort of normalized an engagement with music. Like, being a musician was a normal job. Recording studios were normal places.
And the amount of knowledge people had in the city was, you know, it was unusual.
So instrument makers were everywhere.
Were you more drawn to the outputs of that music industry, or were you more drawn to the recording studios and kind of the mechanics that allowed that output to be produced?
Well, for me, I mean, early on, it certainly was not any consciousness of the technology. You know, I had no idea how music was made, and that was part of the fascination, right? I mean, so this was like late 70s, early 80s, so music was highly processed, and I remember just being in awe of the sounds. And, you know, every now and then I'd encounter an acoustic instrument, I couldn't figure out like how this acoustic instrument, like an acoustic guitar or piano, related to the kind of sounds I was hearing on the radio, you know? So I remember that being fascinating. And then by the time I actually had piano lessons, now in retrospect, I would say the thing that sort of led me to be the kind of musician I am, or sound artist, is that I was interested in these kind of granular parts of sound. You know, I remember, kind of begged my mother for some instruments, and, you know, she eventually got me a piano, which was a big deal because we didn't have a lot of money. And I'm not sure if I started piano lessons yet, but I was really obsessed with the resonances of the piano. You know, I remember just playing chords and pedaling. Yeah. You know, which is a common experience for a lot of kids, but it was, I was interested in the kind of reverberation produced by the instrument. So the technology, yes, but of acoustic instruments. And that was a fascination, you know.
I wonder if maybe you could define how you might think about tools in music, and what is the role of a tool?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think in general, when we talk about what people call technology, we do approach them, you know, we do approach it as a tool. Mm-hmm. But a tool is a broad concept. So sometimes there's like very literal things. We're like, okay, we want to use this specific tool, but sometimes we're just thinking about, what do we need to do and what do we have to do it with?
Right.
So I don't know what Keith would say about this, but my first thought about what you said was, a lot of how I come to this process is through the voice. And so when I think about that, on the one hand, when I think about what is my voice, I have learned a lot about what I want to do with my voice in relation to a microphone. But the other part of it is that what people hear in the process is often an interaction between us, even if it's just my voice. So that how Keith approaches processing my voice, for example, is us making a voice together.
Yeah, I guess the other thing I'd have to say about tools is I think coming from music gave us a critical relationship to tools, you know.
Right.
Now, I would say looking at how people thought about processes in the art world helped us continue to develop it. But, you know, like we grew up in the time of hip hop, and a lot of what we did was sort of modify, you know, the music machines to meet our own needs. Like they weren't designed to, you know, quantize things in this way or to produce these overmodulated sounds, but those were the things we needed it to do. And so then we brought that same kind of, Mindy and I, we brought that same kind of sensibility to, what we might do in art and certainly with language. Now, Mindy was already working as a writer and thinking about all the ways that language makes meaning. But I think all those ways of kind of reworking things, hacking things, and understanding, you know, all of these tools, you know, the tool of language, the tool of concepts, and actual physical machines, understanding how to repurpose those things and how to get at the meaning produced through machines. Yeah.
I think you've been working together for 25 years now, if I'm not mistaken, or thereabouts. But it's amazing because, you know, I was looking back and I really appreciated the kind of timeline that you have on your website, because it was very helpful in just sort of charting the prolific output that you've had over that period. One of the things that I really enjoyed was the way that you were thinking about different types of projects, and you sort of categorized your work into kind of different typologies. You categorize some as praise songs. You have others that you describe as opera masquerades. You know, rather than just individual projects, it seemed as though you were thinking about here's a series of projects that sort of fit this criteria. And I wasn't sure if it was like something that was kind of retrospectively applied, yeah. where you were like, this is something, yeah. you know, to look back onto what you've done, or if it was something that you've been, you know, thinking about as yeah. you've, you know, been producing the work?
I would say it's both. Both. You know, like some things we started out many years ago, even before, you know, we knew how we'd do the thing or where we'd show it or how we'd get it done. We knew, you know, some things we say, okay, we know we want to do a series like this and here's how it'll function. And other things we look back and we say, oh, I, you know, three projects in, I guess it's a series, you know.
three was the magic number.
Yeah, three
sometimes, yeah. Now it's like, yeah.
You know, sometimes you do two things and you're like, I don't know if that's a series or if I'm just trying to fix things from the first one, you know. But then, you know.
Once you do three, you're like, okay, three, I know what this is.
Okay. You know.
Yeah.
So there are things like, you know, we have a series of Americana suites, all right, and these are all projects dealing with, you know, key moments in American history. And I cannot remember now if we knew that from the first, from the first project. Yeah, the first one we did was like in 2007, 2006, 2007, we did a project called Big House Disclosure, which was all about the kind of financial history, the financial legacy of the transatlantic slave trade. So we did that project with Northwestern, and we were tracking the stock prices of corporations that benefited from the slave trade. So there are many banks and insurance companies that still exist today that existed in some form, you know, in the 19th century. And so we did an installation, a sound installation, and made a 200-hour house song that, you know, sort of shifted with the stock prices of these companies. And so that was a little different from the project we'd done before then. And after that, you know, we did other things about, you know, DNA in the Jefferson and Hemings family. We did things about freedom songs, and all of these things reflected on American history in some way. And they were musical, they were sound installations. They often had a book accompanying them, maybe a video piece, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, when we did the first one, they were, it was a related to the kinds of ideas we'd had before and related to some of the processes, but the scale was a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And it was able to happen in a physical space where before, if we'd done things with a lot of nodes, it had been an internet project. And so later we realized that these were themes we were going to return to, but the scale was important, not just to communicate to others, but to us, you know, what we wanted to achieve when we started out on a project that we were going to consider an Americana suite. So right. We'd had a couple of them before we did it, but once we realized that was a kind of series we were going to continue, that told us something about scope as well as content.
Yeah.
I didn't think about the fact that maybe one, you know, I didn't really think about how we're going about these things, but yeah, we really at that point clearly sort of moved away from doing internet projects, and maybe that's why there's more of a kind of American domestic focus in a really articulated way. I mean, certainly, you know, I would say even our internet things have an American point of view, but we weren't just talking to mm-hmm. people in America, but these things were physical installations that were usually commissioned for, you know, specific sites. And mm-hmm. so that kind of shaped right. the content in some way.
One of your pieces, Fit the Battle of Jericho, which I believe you made in 2019, gained fairly widespread public recognition. I wonder if you could speak a little bit, you know, first of all, like what the piece was and is, if you don't mind sharing some more about your decision to essentially reject a potential award from ZKM yeah. based in Germany, and sort of how that process played out for you.
Yeah. So the piece, I think we made it, it might've been 2016, right? So
I can't remember the year.
So we made it for the Met, in the Met's new building, the Breuer building, you know, when they moved into the old Whitney space, and our friend pianist Vijay Iyer was doing a residency there. So you know, essentially he invited a lot of artists to come play in this space that he had, which was very kind. And so we made this I think we made the only installation for yeah. the space, right? The other people were mainly performers. Mm-hmm. And so it's a multi-channel piece that uses the walls of a gallery. And so, you know, we vibrate the walls, two sort of parallel walls. And so voices pan back and forth. And then there are sign tones that that shake the walls, and at points they sort of interrupt the narrative coming from the voice. And so there's also a song being played.
So yeah, there's a song, a poem, a story, a poem, a song. That's the structure.
So you know, we start out with the song Joshua for the Battle of Jericho, which is an old spiritual, but we're sort of doing our arrangement of it, so we've kind of reharmonized it a bit. And at times, like I said, these sort of sign tones sort of bubble up and overtake the voice. And the sign tones are being generated by search data, Google search data, for the term Black Lives Matter. So you know, we collected search data for like a 2-year period, so 2014 to 2016. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you looked at this on a graph, you could see that there are sort of hot moments where the searches for the term increase, they peak, and then, you know, there's a valley. And that has to do with, you know, the news cycle, right? Like often if there had been a protest or if someone had been killed by police, the term would peak. And then things would settle down, and you know, the searches, you know, there's a kind of ebb and flow. And so we wanted to sonify that. We wanted people to be able to hear that. We wanted to put it in a sort of musical context so people mm-hmm. could feel a kind of arc of these peaks and valleys, and also kind of make a, you know, a kind of sonic ritual, you know, mm-hmm. around these data points. So that was the basic idea of the piece.
I'll just say one thing about the story, because there's a story that the original song is about, which is about a war and a wall coming down. Mm-hmm. And so our story is just it changes the focus about what makes the wall come down. So that's all I'll say about the story.
Yeah.
But it's connected to other things about the process in the piece.
So we've only shown the piece a few times. Like we said, we did it at the Met in 2016. We did it at a place called Nurture Art in Brooklyn,
right?
Small mm-hmm. kind of project space. And then context for this ZKM Gigahertz Award thing. Yeah, essentially, I guess the folks at the Gigahertz Award reached out and said, hey, you know, would you like to apply for this thing? And we said, sure, okay.
Yeah, of course.
we sent in the piece, and a few months later, they wrote back and said, hey, you got an honorable mention. We said, okay, great. Sure. And we went to this awards ceremony, you know, all of this was on Zoom, of course, so we weren't there in person. I think
some people were.
Yeah, some people were. A couple of the artists were there in person. Other people were on Zoom. And we honestly did not have a lot of interaction with the folks at ZKM. It was really just sending information in preparation for the ceremony. So the ceremony is a big, you know, I would say it resembles a television production, you know, but this is streaming on Zoom. So there's...
Right.
There's a host, there are representatives from ZKM, there are representatives from the jury who all speak in this ceremony. So we're waiting in the morning to do a kind of what they call a dress rehearsal for the awards ceremony. And there's a long preamble about diversity and how this is the most diverse year for this award. And there's talk about the challenges with dealing with quality when you have this kind of diversity. And, you know, so upon hearing that, I mean, first of all, you know, I wasn't comfortable with the way the whole diversity effort was being framed. And mm-hmm. then to talk about, you know, some unique problems with quality in a diverse year, you know, it was just not something we wanted to be a part of. You know?
Of course.
Yeah. So that was it. pretty simple.
Understood. And was that your first interaction with ZKM?
Yeah. Okay. We've never really dealt with ZKM before. Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Hopefully your stance is something that can improve the field of sound art as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of the issue is that it's a really broad problem, you know, that often, you know, people who are diversifying for the first time don't don't actually value the diversity that they seek. And so that, you know, we just don't really, it's so common that it has to be spoken about.
Right.
Well, I would say even, you know, we're talking about this because we have this conversation with lots of organizations, you know, I mean, we're in a strange position where we've been working a long time and we know a lot of organizations in this world of media art, new media art, but we're not quite insiders either. Like, you know, we're sort of veteran outsiders. and so, you know, we've had this conversation with some organizations, some that we've known a long time. And, you know, a lot of these organizations who've been largely, you know, white, and I say white in the artists they engage with, white in staff, white in the boards, a lot of these organizations are trying to diversify now. And the question we keep asking people we encounter over and over again is, you know, why, what do you value? You know, why are you diversifying? Obviously there are external pressures, but what do you really value? And
not just because we want to say you don't really care, but really like the way forward has got to have meaning, you know?
Of course.
Yeah.
And I think that was a problem. I mean, that's what was highlighted in that whole ZKM encounter, right? Perhaps their purpose for diversifying was not something we wanted to be a part of. And you know,
right.
if we could have known what this effort was about for them in the first place, I mean, first of all, we didn't know we were signing up for any kind of diversity award, because we wouldn't have done that. But you know, we just want people, you know, these organizations as they're making these sort of late moment efforts to diversify, to really kind of explore their intentions and get some clarity of purpose, because, you know, for people of color who've been in this space for a long time, we're really clear about what we're trying to do, you know.
Right.
Yeah. What are some of the changes, if any, you've seen in terms of these institutional problems that you're pointing to in the time that you've been working?
Yeah, what are some of the changes? I mean,
It's okay to say none.
No, I'm certainly seeing superficial changes, you know?
Yeah.
So we see, you know, people of color brought on staff to a lot of organizations. We see people of color, you know, joining the boards of some organizations. You know, we'll see if it produces anything new.
I think it remains to be seen what those changes really are. I mean, I definitely think that there's some people, particularly younger artists, you know, who are having opportunities that were not available widespread to artists of color 15 years ago, 20 years ago, you know, so that has a potential to have a lasting effect for them. I don't know that it changes older people's outcomes or I also don't know what that'll mean down the road, you know.
Yeah, so there are all kind of interesting things intersecting. I mean, I'm really curious just to see. I see a lot of organizations in the sort of new media art, digital media space, making what seem to be at this point superficial changes, right? So there are these cosmetic changes in terms of who these organizations engage. At the same time, we're in this moment where NFTs are entering, and so,
right,
a lot of corners of this field that have been, you know, really sort of non-commercial spaces for a long time are all of a sudden trying to figure out, well, how can we, you know, make money doing what, you know, most of us who got into this had no concern with money. like most people don't become a sound artist to make a lot of money, or a digital media artist.
What?
And so I'm curious about how this newly, you know, politicized landscape is going to intersect with this hyper-capitalized space. And, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm curious. It's definitely going to produce a new kind of work. And in that sense, I'm interested.
If I might just ask you to speculate a little further, do you have a sense of what that could mean for future generations?
I mean, you know, one possibility that concerns me is that as arts organizations, music organizations that have been largely white, largely male, as they start to diversify, if they start to sort of resort to determining value now based on market value, well, then we'll just say, okay, well, it's still the white male digital media artists that matter because, you know, we know these women, we know these people of color are not, you know, selling in this space, you know, in the same kind of way. So that's a concern, but, you know, I really have no idea, you know, what's going to happen, how it's all going to play out, these kind of political concerns, the new market for digital culture.
I mean, that's a good question. You know, that is what I want to know too. But I think my only thought about this was, we're in such early days.
That's, you know, so true.
We don't really know if what's happening this year is going to happen next year. you know, so I don't even know if this is going to be like, do you remember that year when, you know, all of a sudden institutions got political? You know, I don't know if that's going to be what happens or if it's going to really change the future. I really can't tell, you know?
I hear you on that. Could you share a little bit about what your kind of creative practice looks like? Like, what is a typical day working together and creating? And does it start with a sound? Does it start with an idea, a writing? And what does that kind of feel like when you go into that act of creation and exploration? I would love to just kind of know, you know, from the inside a little bit, what you all experience as you're creating new works.
You could start with anything, first of all. Sometimes it starts with an image, like a recent project we worked on started with some images and then a story and then sounds came. Well, I don't know if it's right to say they came last, because in some ways they're sounds that we're always thinking about but didn't know what they were going to go to. You know, I don't know that there's a beginning, really. I mean, there's not a beginning in time. Sometimes there's a beginning for the project, but it's not necessarily the first thing that is made.
I would say often we start up, this starts with a conversation.
Yes,
all kind of things.
That's right. Yeah.
You know.
That is the beginning. Yeah.
And especially now, you know, as we mentioned, we've been working together a long time, but, you know, we have kids now. There are fewer moments where we're just sitting around in the studio trying to make something happen. Like nowadays, we have to break away from everything else we're doing in order to come to the studio. And sometimes it's like one of us coming at a time, you know? So Mindy's putting down ideas, I'm putting down ideas. Or neither of us can get to the studio. And so right. We're talking about what we're going to do when we get to, you know.
While chopping, you know, onions for dinner.
Right.
Yeah. So that's a lot of it. Right. So talking like, oh, do we think we might approach it like this? We might approach it like that. Now, of course, you know, once we get in the studio and start working, things are completely different from anything that got hashed out in a conversation. Mm-hmm. So there's that. There are the conversations that, and that's often the genesis of a project. There's, for many of our projects, even the things that are completely improvised in the studio in some way, there's a research component. It often just shows up like as a as a vibe, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we do a ton of research and that kind of sets our mood and our intention for the piece. And then we sometimes go into the studio and improvise, but we've kind of been informed by, you know, a couple months of research or something.
Yeah, you're making me see that there are things that are very common, you know, like I always think that the order is very different, but there is always a conversation and then research and then a vibe. And that, like, once those things get in order, then the project is happening. Yeah.
Do you find that the way that people are engaging with your work over the last 2 years has changed?
Yeah. I would say there's some differences. I mean, I mean, there are all these things coming together, right? So we've talked about the fact that, you know, after the murder of George Floyd, then there was this kind of global consciousness around the Black Lives Matter movement and the Black political struggle. So that has impacted how people have seen the work we're making in the moment, how they see the work we've made over the last couple of decades. So there's a different kind of lens on our work. And then all of that coincided with the pandemic, right? And so there, because of the pandemic, people were like returning to an interest in internet art, digital media art broadly, anything that could be engaged online, you know? And so, I think that's shifted how people have engaged our work. I mean,
yeah.
Over the pandemic, I mean, before the pandemic, I think we had a lot of things on the calendar, sort of site-specific projects that might have happened in different places. And then a lot of those things got delayed. And then all of a sudden we're doing lots of Zoom talks and sort of streaming projects, which like is fine. Like that's what we might have been doing anyway, only, you know, fewer people would have been interested.
That's funny. Yeah. Well, I mean, I understand that you were planning to go to China in summer of 2020.
Yeah. We're supposed to be going to China like right before the pandemic hit the U.S.
Yeah.
Right. And mm-hmm. and we were in conversation with a friend there who had invited us, and we really had no idea how big things had gotten there.
Yeah.
I mean,
we knew something had happened, but I didn't think of it as being everywhere in China, even, you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. like we were going to Hunan Normal University. It was not the part of the, you know, it was just, I hadn't really thought of it, of everything being affected because it wasn't happening here yet.
Right. When our friend told us that, you know, we knew that our trip was going to be delayed, and we were trying to figure out, you know, how many months we were going to be delayed. You know, we said, okay, we know coronavirus is happening. And at some point she said, well, all of our universities is shut down now.
We were like, what?
We really couldn't conceive, you know, at that point, we were like, yeah. What does that mean? All of the universities are shut down, right? We soon learned.
We know now.
What it means. That's not something you hear every day. That's not,
right.
That's, right.
I get that. I also wanted to ask a little bit about, you know, some of the writing that you did. I believe it was in How to Listen in a Pandemic. You know, one of the distinctions you made that I thought was so lovely was how when people were self-quarantining a century ago, they were listening to stride pieces on player pianos as they sort of, you know, coped with being alone. And you made that distinction to nowadays where, you know, we have the internet and we have the kind of streaming activities that we do. And is that something that you see sort of continuing as we reach whatever this next stage is of emerging from the pandemic?
I imagine so. Not necessarily because of the pandemic. Hopefully mm-hmm. the pandemic will continue for years.
Yeah.
But I just think now we have another way of listening and another way of being together. That I think it'll change, but I don't think it'll go away. I just think it's a lane that we all know we can explore.
Yeah, I think what I'll say to that is I think for some of us, the idea of kind of digital intimacy is not a new thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I would say it's largely generational. I mean, for our generation, I would say, even for our generation, not everybody came online or has had kind of important personal experiences online. But now this has become the norm for everybody, and seeking out, you know, digital intimacy is normal now.
Right.
And so, I mean, as an artist, I think that opens people up for new kinds of art experiences online, you know, so there's an opportunity to engage people in a way that, you know, for, you know, some older generations, people older than us, the idea of having a kind of profound experience online was, you know, people weren't looking for that online. But now we get so many of our experiences through online communication and online experiences. And I think it, you know, people are just looking for a different kind of sensory engagement online. And I don't think it's going to go anywhere, you know.
What is something about the power of sound as an art form that you know that you wish everyone was aware of?
You know, I'll just say, and I don't know, I feel like Keith is about to say something. And the sound can be a space, you know, it can be a place that where you are and not just something to consume. And so for me, as an artist, but also just as a listener, you know, I can go to different places by, you know, by listening to certain things, and I can also make spaces for people, you know. And we have talked a lot about what we want to give to people in this moment. You know, it's weird that a lot of the it's a kind of odd thing for us that like institutions are talking about the kinds of things that we've been talking about for a long time, but sometimes they feel horrible, you know, like what people are doing is not always, you know, something that's supposed to be, you know, a place that helps people cope with, or, you know.
What do you mean specifically?
Well, I feel like we're in a moment where people are like, oh, violence against Black people. Let's make lots of things about that. And they don't, it's just like, you're vulnerable, you know? And I feel like we do need to face what is out there, but, you know, it's not exactly responsible to just make everyone vulnerable all the time, you know? Like there's gotta be a space for another kind of reflection, another kind of way forward, and sometimes just another place to be. So when we think about this, it's like we've always been talking about these issues. We don't really want to not talk about them. But when we've thought about what we can offer, it is about a place for reflecting so that people can actually move through, people can overcome, or people can make action. So that's what I'm thinking about, Sam.
Yeah, I would say you know, when you first asked the question, I thought, well, I don't know if I know anything about sound that other people don't know. I mean, I know things from my practice, but in terms of how people experience sound, I'll say, I think we're all kind of experiencing it the same way. But I guess, you know, after hearing you talk and thinking about it some more, I think there's a... So many of us, like, you know, if you're not an artist, if you're not a musician, we think of music, for example, as a consumable thing. And this is a kind of American view on music, but I think it's become a global one through consuming music through the music industry. And part of why we use the term sound artist as opposed to musician, experimental musician, or any other term that we might use is because I kind of feel like, you know, sound is this larger umbrella and music has become this kind of subcategory, this commercialized subcategory in many ways. And I think often what we're trying to point to with our work is all of these things that human beings have done with sound, certainly before you could put it in a little commercial box. I mean, you know, I'm not sure if we're inventing anything new, but there are so many things that, you know, human beings have been doing, like in terms of constructing space, framing memory, affecting the heart. All of these things have been done through how we engage with sound and how we listen. That's why we're in this.
Thank you. Yeah. And also, I guess in closing, could you share a little bit about the Ogene Sound Art Award that you're involved in, and sort of what it is and sort of where it might be going into the future?
So we've been talking for a long time about a couple of issues that led us to create the prize. So one is that a lot of times there's this kind of singular view on one Black artist in a form at a time. And we wanted to interrupt that. And also we just felt like we needed to use whatever attention and platform we have to point to others in the other Black sound artists with whom we want to be in dialogue and who we also want to have attention. I mean, I think one of the things is the dialogue part is the most important part of that for us, because often we're not placed in the context of not just other Black sound artists, but the the aesthetic traditions and legacies and conversations, you know, to which we actually think we're a part, So we really wanted to make another way of connecting forms and people. And so not just us and people who win the prize, but also the jury. So,
The only thing I add to that is just a simple way to concretize a salute, right? So, you know, there are a lot of good people out there, doing fascinating work. And sometimes, some of the people we point to with this award, we might shine a light on them and they might get more attention. Other people might be, much better known than we are. But mm-hmm. these are people that we think are doing fantastic work. And, it's just nice to salute people.
Right? Yeah, absolutely.
And the conversation we've had with the jury members have also been really fantastic, about what, what are we talking about when we talk about Black people in sound art? Like that in itself has also been on the private side a really important thing for us too.
And sort of finally, what's next for you?
We got a lot of projects on the horizon.
let's see. We're working on a musical satellite. This is a thing that we've been sort of sketching out for a long time, and now it's picking up some steam, and so hopefully, that'll be launched this year. So the project's called Ring Shout. So it'll orbit the Earth and it'll play a version of a ring shout, and it'll engage some text by Octavia Butler and have, voices of children, a lot of things going on in our musical satellite. So we're going to be talking about that Carnegie Hall. Carnegie Hall is during the Afrofuturism month, I guess. And so on February 18th, we'll be talking about that project, Ring Shout. We're doing it with American Composers Orchestra, Apollo, and the National Black Theater. So those organizations are supporting the project. Mm-hmm. We're doing some sonic text that will be happening at the Caramore Festival of Music and Art. So that's in Katona, New York. Mm-hmm. And so we're building some sculptural pieces that deal with sonic text from Black writers. So these will be word sculptures that make sound.
Amazing.
It was in my head. I can't remember. Oh, a bunch of things. We're going to be doing a project for the biennial at Cornell.
Mm-hmm. Cornell University. So we're working with the idea of birds. That place. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you both so much. It was just a real pleasure to learn more about your work and just to have a chance to sort of hear what you're thinking. And
great talking to you.
Thank you so much.
I appreciated the opportunity to speak to Mindy and Keith Obadike, as well as learn about some more of their current work. I highly suggest that you take a moment to check it out if you don't already know it. And I appreciate you listening today. We have a lot in store at Informer for the rest of the year, and I hope you'll come along for the journey. Until next time, thanks for joining me at Informer, and I hope that you'll join us again.